What can the collapse of a 19th century dam teach us about modern leadership? How do the echoes of the past engineering failures and triumphs shape the decisions that we make today? Whether you are managing a team, building your career, or simply trying to make better choices, understanding history isn't just about avoiding past mistakes. It's about uncovering timeless principles that can transform how we lead. Hi. I'm Dr. James Bryant, the host of the Engineer Your Success podcast, and in this episode, we're going to extract leadership lessons from digging into the past with our guest, Michael Bennett.
Success isn't just about what you achieve. It's about living a life that reflects your values and priorities. Welcome to Engineer Your Success, the podcast that helps you lead with intention and live fulfilled.
Today, we have a very special guest, Mr. Michael Bennett. Michael, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
I'm a geotechnical PE with Gannett Fleming Trans Systems in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. I also author the Geotech History blog for the Geo Institute of the American Society of Civil Engineers.
At Engineer Your Success, we're here for leaders like you. Leaders who know there's more to life than just checking off accomplishments. Imagine feeling confident in your decisions, clear in your direction, and fulfilled in both your career and personal life. Whether you're looking to build executive presence, master the art of dynamic balance, or lead with greater purpose, we are here to help you make it happen. You don't have to choose between success at work and fulfillment at home. You can thrive in both. Visit www.engineeryoursuccessnow.com to learn more about how we help leaders like you turn aspirations into action and success into something truly meaningful. Engineer your success, because thriving isn't just for others, it's for you. That's interesting. Your background really combines your engineering expertise with a deep passion for history. Can you tell us just how those two interests came together?
I think there's a perception of some folks to wonder how I got two passions that are fairly dissimilar, but I guess I just always kind of saw them as two things I really enjoyed. As a kid, I liked to tell people that I was always either playing with my Thomas the Tank Engine trains, or I was reading books about the presidents. And as a kid, I often went to some of the railroad museums near me, like the Railroad Museum of Pennsylvania near Lancaster and the Steamtown National Historic Site up in Scranton. I dragged my parents there more times than they probably care to remember, but I never got tired of looking at the locomotives and the passenger and freight cars. And as I got older, of course, it was necessary for me to start thinking about what I wanted to do after high school. Realized, wait a minute, I could make a career out of civil engineering. So that was the option I went with, but I never really got away from my passion for history. I took a couple history classes in college, and I realized I had enough room in my schedule to try to swing a degree in that. And so I did manage to swing a degree in history and a degree in Civ E. And obviously, when you're in grad school, that has to take a backseat a little bit, but there was still plenty of opportunity to explore the history of the field. We read a lot of papers from the 50s and 60s that obviously, the time of writing has long since passed us by, but the importance of the concepts is not. And during COVID, obviously a terrible time for all of us, and those of us who were fortunate enough to stay healthy and stay employed faced the dilemma of what do we do with all this time that we have on our hands that we can't use to socialize or go out or things like that. My hobby was actually reading geotechnical books, really to try to sharpen my skill set. And at some point, James, it just kind of hit me that all this knowledge seemed to have been brought down on tablets from Sinai. It's the version of geotech history I like to call, and on the third day, Terzaghi created effective stress, and he saw that it was good. And I said, look, it's no knock on Terzaghi to say that this field's history has to be more nuanced than this. In fact, I think that's something Terzaghi would have agreed with, judging by the fact that he once said that the field of geotech had been ready for creation by the time he came along. He just happened to be the one to do it.
When you think about this evolution, you're growing up as a kid, you really like history, you like engineering, transportation, railroads. You see this as a natural evolution. For you, it seems like these two puzzle pieces fit real neatly, like it was always there, always something that you would do. But the other interesting thing, at least about your background as in preparing for this interview is that you also started a geotechnical history blog. And so what inspired you to start that blog, and what was that initial vision when you started that?
For sure. So actually kind of picks up nicely from where we were talking about the history of the field and how it is has to be more nuanced than just one guy, and how geotech history is often presented as kind of the story of leaders and pioneers in history. It's what we would call the great man theory. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with telling that way of history, but it's kind of a dated way of doing it. It's not nearly as common these days. And I said, there has to be a better way to tell this story. And I figured, why not me? And so my first idea was to write a book. Thank God I've been friends with Thomas Kennedy for years, because Thomas was my VT grad school roommate, one of my best friends at VT, still a good friend of mine. And he and I would talk regularly about whatever nutty idea I was proposing that day. So he was very used to what I call Michael's crazy schemes. And when I bounced the book idea off of him, he said, you know, I thought, okay, well, at least I've had enough schemes shot down by now that it's not a stunner. But then he did stun me by saying, Mike, would you consider a blog? He said it would be easier. We could write shorter form stuff. And it wouldn't be the onerous commitment that a book would represent. And so I actually went to a couple of kind of more experienced folks in the geotech field and really tried to talk to them about what I was interested in doing, what Thomas and I were interested in doing at this point. And I kind of figured that it would be politely received, and then I would be told, well, Michael, this is how things work, and that's just not feasible. But to my surprise, the folks I talked to said, this would be a really valuable contribution. You ought to go for this. So initially, Thomas and I had our own website, and we published blog entries for about 2 years. He's near Raleigh. I'm near Philadelphia. And eventually, interests diverged, and he decided, you know what, Mike, I think this is in good hands. I'll leave it with you. And we've kept in touch, stayed friends, but this has, from that point on, kind of been more of a solo venture. And it was around that time that the Geo Institute of ASCE approached me and said, how would you like to do a blog with us on our website? And I thought, oh, wow, talk about a larger pulpit.
How has that transition gone for you from transitioning from you doing the blog on your own website, now you're doing it for the Geo Institute?
It's been great. I can't say enough good things about Brad Keeler and Liz Cassino at the Geo Institute. They've been terrifically supportive. They've given me good input. Elizabeth does a wonderful job taking the entries and pictures that I send her and turning them into something on a web page that actually looks nice. And so they've been great partners. 10 out of 10 would recommend.
One of the more fascinating aspects of your work and the conversations that we've had is how you draw lessons from historical engineering stories. Can you talk about some of your favorite blogs or stories that deal with those issues?
Sure. So I think the one that really sticks out in my mind is the one, James, that I did on the Jonestown flood, because I read about the disaster as a little kid and, you know, one of those old Reader's Digests compilations of great disasters. And then as a freshman in college, I read David McCullough's book on the flood, which is still considered the authoritative history of it, because he was able to find archives, know what it dug into. He found survivors of the flood in their 80s and 90s by then, and he spoke with them. And it's a very good read. And one time I was out in Pittsburgh for my then employer's holiday party. And on my way back, I said, I'd really like to see the dam that broke and caused the Johnstown flood. And the second I saw it, I said, well, actually, I won't tell you what I said because it's not fit for air, but it was just so astonishing. It was one of those moments where I swore, not because I thought it was cool, but because I was so taken aback that there was no other word for it. Just standing there, you feel this overwhelming sense of being astonished and stunned into silence. I'm not an easy person to stun into silence. My family can tell you that. But I was at a loss for words. And I felt interested in learning more about the geotech side of the disaster. So McCullough did a great job covering the history side, but by his own admission, he wasn't an engineer. And then I found a book from a geologist at Pitt Johnstown, who covered kind of the hydraulics and hydrology of the flood. And that's a really great resource. His name's Neil Coleman. Excellent book. And then I tried to find as good a resource as those two on the geotech of the flood. There wasn't any. And usually if a mouse squeaks on top of a dam, an engineer has tried to write a paper about it. But for some reason, the deadliest dam failure in U.S. history had not had a geotech write-up. And I said, well, I'm completely unqualified for this job, but I'll give it a try. So the first Thomas and I wrote a version of the post. And then when ASCE asked me to start blogging on the Geo Institute website, I was kind of, as I said, going into more of a solo direction at that point. And I said, wait a minute, I am going to make my first impression with this entry. I need to pull out all the stops. And so I did. I dug out every source I could think of, and that turned into a 5-part series on the flood. And I think it was well received. It's never easy to tell, but people seemed to appreciate it. And then I'd actually contacted a number of experts in that process, dam engineers who knew a heck of a lot more than I did on the subject. And one of them said, you know, I think this would make a good write-up for the Association of State Dam Safety Officials. So I went back to all those sources I had described, corrected a couple of mistakes, and I also tracked down new sources because they're coming out on the flood still to this day, and I added those things in. And I was able to put that into a write-up for ASDSO on their webpage, on their dam failures and incidents site. And I'll also be presenting a webinar about 90 minutes long on that subject to them in May.
What are some lessons learned that we may tend to forget? You know, what lessons have you learned from your exploration of history and engineering that you want to make sure that we're reminded of?
I think the biggest one is probably that our work doesn't happen in a vacuum, whether it's for geotechnical engineers, my specialty, or for civil engineers in general. And I think a disaster like the Johnstown flood makes very, very clear how serious the impacts of our failures can be on people's lives. But it's kind of cynical to just focus on that, or even if not cynical, it's not the whole picture. Because the successes we have as engineers can also have enormous positive impacts on people's lives. I always think of the Lincoln Memorial and how that was intended when it was engineered to just be a structure honoring Lincoln. And at the time it was dedicated, it was kind of presented as an honor to Lincoln the unifier rather than Lincoln the emancipator, because unfortunately that was the perspective that was politically palatable. But then you look at Marian Anderson singing at the Lincoln Memorial, you look at MLK and the March in Washington and I Have a Dream, and you see the meaning of the structure change. It's not like the civil engineering of the structure changed its meaning, but the civil engineering made the structure possible, and the structure in turn interacted with and impacted people in a way that changed its meaning. At its roots, we as civil engineers did have an impact on society through our engineering of that structure. So that, I would say that's kind of a counterweight example of the Johnstown flood, of an uplifting story of engineering.
I've never really thought about the civil engineering, architecture, or things from that perspective of the impact that those structures play in history in the cultural context that they're used and people are there. I think that's a really interesting, I want to kind of shift perspectives a little bit or shift gears. And let's just talk about you as a leader, your career arc.
If we're going to talk about my career arc in terms of leadership, James, I think it really needs to start almost before my career starts, because I would say that the one thing that I did that taught me leadership more than anything was Boy Scouts. I'm very lucky with the parents I've had. I have a great mother and father. And so it was even luckier that my scoutmaster, Steve D'Antonio, has been like a second father to me, because now I have two great fathers instead of just one. And his style of leadership is something I really seek to emulate. He's a great leader by example, just kind of, you know, he doesn't point fingers, gets the job done, knows how to mediate between parties who don't always agree, and is very good at saying at some point, guys, we've had a debate, we've had a discussion, but here's the decision, and this is what we're going to do moving forward, which is a very difficult act as a leader, but he does it really well. And so as a Boy Scout, I served as an assistant patrol leader, assistant senior patrol leader, and kind of climbed the leadership ranks that way, and I really had the chance to just interact with people and see what didn't motivate them and what did, and how I could be a good leader. I started to get older. I was president of the music honors group at my high school, and then I did a stint as the treasurer of Engineers Without Borders at my college, and then I kind of capped it off by serving as president of the Talbot Applied chapter at Lafayette, and I tried to incorporate the lessons Mr. D, as we affectionately call him, had taught me at every step of the way.
And so if you were to coin those lessons again for the listeners, let's look at the top three lessons from Mr. D.
Gosh, Mr. D taught so many good ones. I think three that really come to mind. One, lead by example, because obviously people will follow your orders if you're in charge to some extent, but you're going to have a much greater impact on them with the things you don't say when you're a leader, or just what you do and how you act, how you comport yourself. Two, I think Mr. D is living proof of the old advice that a soft answer turns away wrath. I've seen him get angry once or twice, but only for about a combined total of 30 seconds. And his ability to stay level-headed and to not let anyone get his goat and just kind of stay calm and keep the peace is, I think, really terrific. I've heard tell of a couple of troop committee meetings where people were arguing about one thing or another, and Mr. D would get everyone kind of back together just by shaking his head and saying, you know, all I wanted to do was take a bunch of boys camping. So I would say that's the second lesson. And then the third would just be the importance of exercising your authority sparingly and kind of giving people a very wide berth, a long leash. One thing Mr. D did very, very well, James, and still does very well, is that he was always adamant that we were a Boy Scout troop and we had to be led by the boys. So we weren't told, for instance, what camping trips we were going to be going on. We would bring ideas to a meeting with all the patrol leaders and the senior leaders, and we would talk about, here's what we as the scouts want to do. And that was how we picked our camping trips. And, you know, not every trip was feasible, and sometimes we were told, okay, look, we can't swing that one. But the fact that that input was encouraged and even expected was something that I really came to appreciate, because not all leaders do that, but I think the really good ones do.
How has this translated into you as a leader within your field?
Well, I'm only in my early 30s. I wouldn't say I'm necessarily a full-fledged leader just yet, but I try to take those lessons to heart in what I do every day. I just try to act like the person that I would want to see in a leadership position. It's not to say I don't have my moments. We all do, but I really try to behave as though I were a leader I was looking up to. I admit that interpersonal diplomacy does not always come to me naturally, but I've really worked on it and practiced it, and I think I'm a lot better now than I have been previously. Just that value of, you know, sometimes when someone says something that really gets your goat, being able to pause for a second, think about how to handle it constructively, and then responding. Kind of that split second of hesitation before you do something you might regret, that has been really helpful. And that has helped me steer a number of conversations in a more productive direction. And then the other lesson, I guess, just giving people a long leash. I am at the point now where I'm starting to manage other folks, not on projects, but on specific tasks. Somebody, I might say to someone, I need you to get these boring logs together, or I need you to write out a draft of this, and I'll give them guidance. And obviously, if they need help, they know they can reach out to me. I don't want them to struggle. But I also try to make sure that there's room enough for them to learn to swim. It's like that scene in True Grit where John Wayne asks the kid if he can swim. The kid says he doesn't know, and John Wayne throws him into a creek. Now, obviously, he's not going to drown this kid. He's standing right there, but the kid's learning more about how to swim by thrashing about than he would be reading a book. And that's kind of the attitude I try to take, to give people enough leash to develop their skills on their own, but also to let them know, hey, I'm here if you need a lifeline.
Okay. No, I think those are all good lessons. And, you know, one of the comments that you make, you're just starting to manage people. But in reality, Michael, you've been leading from where you are at every step of the way. Whether you're talking about the leadership positions that you had in the Boy Scouts or in undergrad or in grad school or in different societies, you have been exhibiting leadership all the way through your education and your career. And so the question that I want to ask now is, so we've talked about what you see or the qualities that you see in good leaders. Now, everybody may not be exhibiting those qualities. So, you know, there may be someone, an engineer, someone who's listening to this. That's like, you know, the people that are over me, my boss, I really wish I could help them be better leaders. And I guess this gets to the concept of managing up. Do you have any suggestions, or can you talk about your experience in managing up?
Gosh, it's difficult to manage up because on one hand, the supervisor's in charge and you do have to respect that at the end of the day. And on the other hand, you know, if the supervisor is not communicating effectively with you, the end product's not going to be very good and no one's going to be happy. So I guess two things that come to mind right off the bat, James, for managing up are first, just the importance of clear communication. And that's such a trope at this point that I feel we kind of say communication, got it, next. But I think it's important to just kind of stop and reflect on what exactly that means. And for me, it means when a project manager tells me something, I go over it with them. Here is what I've heard that you want. A, B, C, and D. This is what you want, right? Then sometimes it's exactly what they have in mind. And sometimes, well, I also kind of was thinking about E, and just that idea that making sure that what they've said and intended is what you've heard, because it's always kind of those unspoken assumptions that come and bite you in the butt if you're not careful.
I think that's great advice because you're making sure that there's clarity.
Well, thank you. And the other of the two points I guess I'd make right off the cuff is kind of being a responsible subordinate of, you know, at some point the order is the order. You've got to carry it through. But most bosses I've learned are not really interested in just people who follow their every word without really thinking about it. Most of them want you to consider what it is that they want you to do and think about on your own whether there are better ways to do it. An example would be that I was once working on a project that involved the foundation for a dynamic message sign out in Western Pennsylvania. And this project was situated right above an abandoned coal mine. So this coal mine was underlain by claystone. So the plan was, okay, no big deal. We'll take the deep foundation. We'll case it through the coal mine so grout doesn't flow everywhere. And then we'll terminate in the claystone. And I actually said to the project manager, claystone is notoriously weak bedrock. Are you sure we want to do this? Just very kind of, look, it's your call, but here's a concern we should consider, I think. And he said, well, I'm glad you brought it to my attention, but I don't think we need to be concerned. So we sent it to our internal QA reviewer. And this guy came back and commented, pile should not be terminated in claystone. Please extend deeper. And so that was kind of a good example of, on one hand, my judgment was validated. But on the other hand, I had done it in a way that I hadn't embarrassed my supervisor, which is absolutely critical. And there's also a lot to be said, I guess, if there were a third point to be made, James, that you need to get to know your boss's personality and kind of what floats their boat. Like I've had some people who have been my supervisors, whose idea of shooting the breeze was, good morning, Michael, how are you? And then there are other folks who are happy to talk for 10, 15 minutes about whatever is going on. And you don't want to be rude and just kind of say, hey, I got stuff to get back to. So just learning to read their personalities like that as well is an important thing.
You've mentioned that interpersonal skills was not necessarily something that comes natural to you or a strong suit. Can you talk about the evolution of your emotional intelligence or just a story behind why this became important to you?
So when I was a freshman in college, after the summer after that year, my family went on a vacation up to kind of southern Utah and the Zion National Park area. And we were on the road heading to some trailhead. And we asked a couple locals for directions. And these guys gave us directions. I've always had a decent sense of direction. I could tell right away that they weren't getting us to where we needed to be. And my parents said, no, these are the locals. They've probably got a good idea. And I finally said, okay, if you want to take these directions, take the directions. But I've been navigating to this point, and I'm going to turn the navigating over to you. Well, sure enough, the locals' directions were wrong. And I noted as much. And my parents' response to my surprise was not, oh, good for you for getting the directions right. It was like, yeah, great, you're right. But if you hadn't been a donkey about it, so to speak, maybe we would have listened to your directions. But you can't just yell at people and expect that they're going to listen to you. And that was kind of a good moment for me to learn in a very safe setting that having the correct facts is not necessarily the only thing that matters in life. In fact, sometimes it's one of the things that matters least. So fast forward about a year, I'm in Spain with a couple of classmates because I spent a semester in Madrid studying abroad. And we were going to get on a train to view some royal tomb just outside of the city of Madrid. It's the local commuter train. And we were at the platform and my classmates said, well, our train is here. I was like, are you sure? I think the train says it's going to point I, and we really want to get to point X for this royal tomb. And they were like, no, we're on the right platform. We're going here. And so it turned out, of course, that we ended up at point Y and not at the royal tombs.
Those are pretty interesting stories. And the story with your parents is a really safe space where you can learn that and then take that and say, okay, maybe there's some changes or things that I can do in the future. My take on communication is that it's incumbent on the person who's communicating to be able to package the information in a way that the people you're communicating to can actually do something with it. Now, they can still make the wrong decision or make a decision different from what I may be advocating, but I do think it's incumbent on me or you or whomever's listening as the communicator to make sure that you're packaging your message in a way that it can be received.
And I mean, history's full of stories like that, too. It's just kind of a mild example that comes to mind. Ronald Reagan, when he was very clearly about to be elected to his first term, was starting to pick the people who he thought would be in his cabinet. And I forget which former general he had decided he wanted as a Secretary of State. And George Bush said, since the election hadn't happened yet, Governor, if this is the man you want for the job, go ahead and pick him, but I don't think he's the right fit. And all of Reagan's aides kind of looked, this isn't looking good for George Bush. He's going against the top guy. Well, Reagan got into office. This guy became Secretary of State and just did not do a good job. Not that he was necessarily ill-intended, but he was, you know, he was used to giving orders and having them be followed, which is not always what a good diplomat has to do. And the guy only lasted about a year, and then Reagan sent him packing. And then at that point, all of Reagan's advisors looked at Bush and said, wait a minute. This guy has really good judgment because he saw this coming before all of us did. But because Bush had presented it in a very respectful way, there was no face lost.
We've talked a little bit about your growth as an emerging leader in effective communication and emotional intelligence. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm as excited to hear the answer to this as you are, because truthfully, James, I don't know. I mean, I just turned 30, so there's that to look forward to and kind of seeing what the next decade holds. I've got a couple upcoming speaking engagements. One is a series of articles to commemorate the 100th birthday of Erdbaum Mechanic, Carl Terzaghi's foundational, no pun intended, book on geotechnical engineering, really the first modern geotechnical book. And so that came out in 1925. The Geostrata magazine of the Geo Institute is putting out a series of commemorative articles on it. And they asked me to write those. So the second thing that I'm excited about is this Johnstown flood webinar that I mentioned. It's going to be with dam professionals from all over the country. That's in May. So I'm looking forward to that. And the third thing is that last year I applied for and just found out that I got a slot to speak at the Geo Congress in Louisville, Kentucky in March. And I've been given about 15 minutes as one of their kind of morning, they call them the pit talks. They're kind of like TED talks, but dealing with geotech things that aren't necessarily nuts and bolts equation solving. And so my talk is going to be titled Geotech History, How We'll Benefit from a Stronger Foundation. And you want to talk about making a good case and persuading people of the soundness of your argument. I've got about 15 minutes to sell people on why this isn't, you know, a beautiful side hobby. Why it is something that's we all as civil engineering professionals or that conference geoprofessionals really need to incorporate in our daily routine.
Yeah. That is really exciting. So say there are some emerging leaders that are listening to this podcast. What message do you have for the emerging leaders? And then what message do you have for those senior level engineers or owners that they should know about the emerging leaders?
Yes, to the kind of cadre of folks in my generation of rising leaders, I would say that perspective comes with hindsight. And so it's not always going to seem clear why you're freezing your knickers off at a site in 20 degree weather watching piles get driven, or why you're working on redrafting a preliminary exploration program that you think should have been good enough already, but To quote 76ers basketball, you got to trust the process. That said, I've also never been a believer in, oh, well, if a door closes, just wait for another one to open. If a door closes, you're also welcome to search for a window and to climb through that. I mean, look at me. I followed the crazy scheme of geotech history writing and it turned into something. I didn't expect that. As for senior leaders, I know the kind of the millennials and the Gen Z folks, we can be a tricky bunch. I admit that generationally, we don't have the best rap, but I would say two things. One, please mentor us, because I think a lot of us are capable of, in 20 or 30 years, the jobs you're doing, but we'll need good mentors to help us get there. And I think a lot of those senior level folks who are there now have had great mentors, which is why they're there and why they're good at what they do. I'm sure many of them hope to pay it forward, and I think now's the perfect opportunity to pay it forward with us. The other thing I would say is just be open to what we have to say and what we bring to the table. We're a generation that has grown up very integrated with technology. The internet, for better or worse, has brought the totality of a lot of knowledge to our fingertips. And there are definitely things that we as a generation just see differently from previous generations. And obviously, like any generation, we have our shortcomings. That cannot, it should not be denied. But we also have strengths. And I hope that the senior level folks feel comfortable leveraging those strengths and bringing us into another quote from Hamilton, the room where it happens.
So, Michael, this has been a fantastic interview. I want to thank you for taking the time to just sit and talk with me and our audience. If people wanted to get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, hit me up on LinkedIn. I check it all the time.
Okay. And we'll include a link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes of the podcast episode. And lastly, do you have any questions for me?
What do you think the role of history in civil engineering could be? I've talked about the potential I see for it, but I want to hear what someone who's a little more established in their engineering and leadership career thinks.
It's interesting. I think that history plays a role in our ability to see what has happened, to take those lessons learned from that, and then leverage those lessons for what we want to do in the future. And it's no different than how I would view our personal history and our personal things that we've overcome. If you continue to take the same actions that you took in the past, and you're not happy with the results that you have, and you continue with those actions, you'll continue to get the same results. So you learn from those that you say, okay, here's the actions that I took. This is the result that I got. I don't want that. So what do I need to change? What in my actions do I need to change to get me to where I want to go? So I guess in a nutshell, that's how I would see history in general playing a role in our continued development and growth.
I think that's well said. And I kind of reached the same conclusion just from the opposite route, where I was fascinated with the study of history as a little kid first, kind of the collective version of how do we learn from our past and our mistakes. And then over time, as I got more emotionally intelligent, I started to see that I could use the same line of reasoning at an individual level to really improve some things that I wanted to work on with myself. That has been an indispensable tool in that process.
That's great. I think it was a great question. Michael, again, I want to thank you for joining us on the show. I'm going to end this podcast episode like I end every podcast episode, and that's this. Many people know what to do. Fewer people know how to do it. And there's a select group of people that actually follow through and do it, and they're living the life of their dreams. Michael, I want to thank you for being part of that select few and leveraging history to help yourself and others do the same.
James, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I've really enjoyed it.